Welcome. You are listening to a UC Davis Center for Poverty Research Conference podcast. I am the center's deputy director, Marianne Page. In January 2014, the center hosted the War on Poverty Conference. The conference hosted top poverty experts from across the country to discuss the U.S. safety net on the 50-year anniversary of the War on Poverty. In this presentation, Martha Bailey presents a quantitative analysis of the War on Poverty's political economy. Bailey is an associate professor of economics and a research associate professor at the Population Studies Center at the University of Michigan. She is also a research associate with the National Bureau of Economic Research.
I'm going to apologize to my discussant because I'm going to talk about things that are not in the paper. And I've been really struggling with this paper. And even though it's been conditionally accepted, I still am not happy with the way it is, and I think I'm going to revamp it. So anyway, just to tell you, but because I think it's really important, and I'm not quite sure how to do it. So this morning I got up, I was kind of struggling with how I was going to talk about it, and so I totally redid it. And so I'm really interested in hearing not the analysis, but the way I'm thinking about the analysis. And I'm going to talk to you about that today. So sorry, Gavin, in advance, but I'm sure that your comments will still be just as important. But the other thing I wanted to start by talking about is what an exciting week this has been for the War on Poverty. And for a lot of you who have been working on this for quite some time, I think this is the first time where I've really seen social scientists and solid research inform a lot of the talking points that we've seen. So as part of leading up to the release of our book, or actually to the publicity that Russell Sage was going to do for our book, I did a lot of research. So Sheldon, in the interim, stopped working at the University of Michigan and is now president of the Russell Sage Foundation, and that has several implications. My thinking on our division of labor would be that I would do a lot of the writing and analysis, and he would talk to the press. Now, when he became president of the Russell Sage Foundation, it turned out he had another job, and that meant that I had to take a lot more of the press and all these things. So I spent a lot of time thinking about what's going to happen when the War on Poverty anniversary comes. What will I say? I'm such a rookie, I have no idea what I'm doing. So I did a lot of looking at what had happened in previous anniversaries so I could prepare myself for the discussion. What are the hard questions you're going to get? What's going to go on? And I was prepared for that. But what I was not prepared for is the way the discussion really took on a different shape this week. And actually, I was really excited to see Paul Krugman write that up in his column, and I wanted to kind of start by thinking about this. So he says, 50 years ago, well, let's see if I can get this to work, have passed since Lyndon Johnson declared a war on poverty. A funny thing happened on the way to this anniversary. Suddenly, or so it seems, progressives have stopped apologizing for their efforts. I think it says on behalf of the poor, and they've started trumpeting them instead, and conservatives find themselves on the defensive. It wasn't supposed to be this way. We know the way it was supposed to be, and that's actually what I learned when I was looking back at a lot of the stuff on the anniversaries. For a long time, everyone knew, or more accurate, right, that war on poverty had been an abject failure, and they knew why. It was the fault of the poor themselves, but what everyone knew wasn't true. And the public seems to have caught it. Okay. The narrative went like this. Anti-poverty programs hadn't actually reduced poverty because poverty in America was still basically a social problem for a lot of reasons. And the impact of this means that defending the poor or talking about poverty was bad politics on both sides. It's been this really bad word for a very long time. I think that changed this week. So anyways, I'm really excited to see a lot of everyone who's been working on this for a long time work in the news. It's so exciting. And I think it's really exciting when a lot of the stuff that we work on all the time in our office sort of comes out of our office and starts to inform some of the public debate. Okay. So that's not in my paper. But so let's go back to this declaration of a war on poverty. That happens in 1964. Here's Lyndon Johnson's. And this is something I more or less took for granted that it made sense to think about the war on poverty as a failure, but that's actually something that I'm thinking more and more about. And let me tell you why. So we know what the war on poverty was, or actually some of the sense of it being a failure is actually not knowing what the war on poverty was. Johnson says no doles. It's supposed to be a hand up, not a handout. The idea is to go beyond treating the symptoms of poverty. Actually, if you looked at some of what Rubio said in his speech, you'll see some of the same language. His New Opportunity Society sounds a little bit like the Great Society. I mean, except for all the programs, but there's some similar rhetoric. Safety net, but also anti-discrimination efforts, human capital efforts, economic growth. The strategy is far-reaching, and I think still just as relevant now, especially if we think about labor markets. And there's tons of lasting policies. There's lots of them that didn't last, but there's tons of lasting ones. And whether or not you think it's supply-side or Keynesian, right? So Johnson really pioneers this idea of economic stimulus through tax cut. There's the Civil Rights Act, safety net programs we've been talking a lot about, these pioneering programs in early childhood, the Elementary and Secondary Education Act, Higher Education Act training programs, the negative income tax experiments, which later developed into the earned income tax credit. There's a huge hike in the minimum wage, about 30%, and Social Security benefit expansions as well as Medicare. So these are programs that have lasted that people on the right and the left will claim. And yet the narrative has been that all of this was a failure. So the other thing that I think a lot about, and the things that social scientists have taken so long to document, it seems to me that a lot of people who lived through this or benefited from these programs must have known about for a very long time. So we know that there were lasting and very immediate effects for a lot of groups in the United States. The elderly are one of those cases that it's just so dramatic, it's hard to miss. We know that the elderly poverty rate fell in half within a decade. But there's two other things, and Ken brought this up a little bit yesterday, and I think that this is really worth noting, is Johnson really plugs Medicare as a program. It's not just for the elderly, it's for middle-class families, right? It's so that you're not burdened with caring for your aging parents or covering their medical costs. This is an important thing, and it's an important part of the social net. And so you can also think about, and this is a project, if any one of you have an idea about how to do this, to think about the ways in which the generations who saved for a very long time for their retirement and for their medical care then probably ended up bequesting a lot of that money to the next generation. So you might think that there's this big intergenerational effect as well, though temporary. The other thing to think about is we tend to, especially social scientists in the interest of identifying effects, tend to think of these things in silos. There's sort of this program and then there's this program and we're looking at these things very narrowly, but we know that they interact in a lot of ways. Sort of there's the cross-sectional interactions, and that's something that Ken's really emphasized a lot in his work, thinking about the way that it's not just the Civil Rights Act, but it's the Civil Rights Act in concert with really big federal carrots that mean that people are really working to desegregate hospitals. It doesn't mean it happened overnight or that it was easy. Same thing with schools. But it does help kind of push the process along. The other thing is we think that there are these intertemporal complementarities between these programs. Food security translates into better readiness for school, translates into better learning, right? That so this is all aided by greater funds for public education, especially in poor districts. And then you also think about the returns to college education and sort of subsidies we give for tuition, those other types of assistance being much more effective because poor kids are much more ready to go. So there's all of these different synergies to think about, and that's actually something we have a really hard time estimating because we can't make these narrow comparisons, but I don't think they're any less relevant. Okay, so why does the war on poverty get a bad rap? Why is this? And you might think it's totally easy, okay? There's a couple things that people have pointed out. One of the dumb things that the Johnson administration did is they came up with a metric of poverty that didn't capture the benefits of a lot of things that they did. Well, that's bad politics. Okay, so we know that, and Jim gave us a really nice paper on that yesterday, so I don't need to tell you more about that. So the idea is, okay, with a more complete accounting, we're going to do much better. Here's another one. Society and the economy changed. So the government was up against extraordinarily big changes in the way that gains from growth were distributed. And this is something that changes in the early 70s, right? It was not the case when Johnson was declaring his war. And so in some people will even claim that this big government spending is one of the things that led to that shift in the economy. Murray. You can also think that this legacy of failure is a conservative rewrite, right, of what actually happened. It's a change in the narrative, a rebranding, a relabeling. And the other type of thing, Alice brought this up last night, has to do with design and implementation. That these things were all good ideas in practice, but they really weren't designed well. Perhaps they weren't implemented as carefully as they could have been. There are lots of things that went wrong. So I want to just stare at the official poverty rate here for a second and think about those narratives, right? And we already know this is flawed for all sorts of reasons, but it still is going to make the point just fine. So when Johnson declares a war on poverty, the official metric is 19%, and within a decade, it drops to 11%. And here's Reagan's State of the Union, where he jokes that we fought the war on poverty and poverty won. So sure, if you're comparing what was the case in the 70s to the 1980s, that makes a lot of sense, that poverty a lot. But one of the things, if you were a sitting president, you declare war on poverty, and poverty rates fell by that much within the next few years, most people would be, right? If Obama's, if the economy had turned around, even if it had nothing to do with the stimulus, they would be plugging this every day on the front page, right? Jobs, anything like that. So it's fascinating to me when I stare at this figure more, I think, why is it that by the early 1970s, we had decided that these things didn't work? Because I'm not saying that when you look at the pre-trend here, social scientists go, oh, yeah, I go, there's some issues with making that comparison. But the general public doesn't typically have that type of thinking at all. We benchmark against what was the case when the program started, and we look at how things change, and we attribute the entire thing to whatever happened in that year, right? So that's the way the media knew. So here, this is a 6 percentage point drop by the time Johnson leaves office. That's a huge drop. Okay. So anyways, back to the conservative rewrite. Okay. Maybe this is what they have just been reinventing the history. But in fact, this idea that the war on poverty failed came up way before Reagan. In fact, there were dispassionate observers and observers on the left who were claiming that this program was an abject failure. So this is a review done by Eli Ginsberg and Robert Solow, which is a lot more generous than some of the left's critique. And they say the Great Society programs, the war on poverty is the most open to criticism. Its promises were extreme. The specific remedial actions were untried and untested. The finances were grossly inadequate. The political restructure was so vulnerable that it had to be radically reformed within a few years after the program. But they were writing at this moment in history where poverty rates were at a historic low. I find this just so striking. And so if you compare this to the New Deal, think about that. Roosevelt has all these programs, all these spending. The Depression didn't end within 4 years or even make significant progress out of that trough. And it's declared and it's remembered in history as this wonderful success of a policy. So for a long time, I had just taken this narrative of failure as kind of as given. But the more I think about this kind of stuff, I find it really, really puzzling. And the other thing that's fascinating here is that the war on poverty becomes this real villain for neoconservatives. And not even the New Deal. The New Deal, they're like, oh, that's fine. But here, when Reagan's criticized for dismantling New Deal programs, he corrects reporters and tells them, no. I voted for FDR 4 times. He then goes on to say, I'm trying to undo the Great Society. That was LBJ's war on poverty that led us to our present mess. So this is a program in an era that gets so much grief for all sorts of things. And when you look, I think, at the record, I think it's striking because we know there are these big effects from all these programs, and effects that maybe social scientists have trouble identifying, but not effects that people had trouble feeling. So this is one of those things that I think that the benefits for people must have been so profound. The people must have known about this, and yet the political rhetoric, the narrative for so long, has been this thing of failure. Okay, so why do they get this bad rap? I was just trying to go through and debunk several reasons for that. So one, the measuring stick is bad. Well, true, but Johnson does pretty well by that measuring stick. Society and the economy changed, yes, but that happened after 1973, and we were already done with the war on poverty, but we had already written it off. Conservative rewrite of history? Well, maybe they grabbed onto some stuff, but actually they weren't the one that started that one, right? There are lots of critiques on the left and the right. Nobody liked this thing by the end of the 1970s. So here's this other thing we come down to. So maybe it's just the fact that we can't stand Johnson. As much as he kind of comes in with all of this enthusiasm, the Vietnam, the race riots, sort of the civil unrest in the 60s, anything associated with him, we're just going to write off. That's possible. I actually can't say very much about that today. But the other thing I want to look at more explicitly is sort of the design and implementation of these programs. And I also want to compare the way these things were structured to the New Deal to think a little bit more about some important differences. And this paper is going to be like none other I've ever written. It's much more narrative and historical. And it's also, there's no like big data, causal inference, anything like that. So it's extremely descriptive. And so it may risk the of doing everything badly. So, but anyways, I'm interested to hear your thoughts on it. Okay, so this paper is How Johnson Fought the War on Poverty, a Quantitative History. In this context, what is it about how they do this stuff that leads people to believe that they got things so wrong? So there have basically been, there's so many tapes and documents and oral histories of this period. I mean, Kent, I'm so glad you played some of that stuff yesterday. LBJ said things to everybody. He could be anything for anyone, right? So he says, how could a person who uses the N-word on a regular basis then push through civil rights? It's just this, like, what was he doing? What was he thinking? Who was he really? What were his motivations? What were they doing with this program, I think, is a really big question. So there's tons of work on this by historians, and there's very little quantitative work, so that's what we want to try to add. So there's two main hypotheses here, and I'm going to simplify all sorts of analysis we did down to these two. So you can think, I'm going to, in the interest of brevity, I'm going to call this first one politics. And it's not clear that you can separate politics from actual what the policies intended to do at all, but I'm just, that's my shorthand. So one of the things you think that they were trying to do with this funding at the Johnson administration was to try to forge a New Deal-type consensus, right, to change the Democratic electorate. And if they're doing that sort of thing, what you would expect, so Johnson's a New Dealer. We know this. We know we spend money in districts. You can get, you know, this worked out very well for FDR. You can imagine him using these funds in exactly the same way. So greater spending in areas where the marginal vote matters more, greater spending in areas where there are more powerful congressmen who can either hold his agenda hostage or push it through. These are the types of things we're going to look for in the data. Greater funding in places that are really swing districts in 1964 or before. Here's the alternative, and this is something that Caro kind of hints at in some of his biographies, but I think is not quite clear. It's like, maybe Johnson was really deeply this humanitarian. Like, despite all of the things we know about him as a human being, maybe there was, he really wanted to do something great. And there are these hints of that, though it's always unclear if he's selling something or he means it, in a lot of the things he does. So there are these big potential benefits, you might think, of fighting poverty and winning it. But you can also think, this is one of the things Caro says, hints of compassion for the downtrodden and a passion to raise them up, hints that Johnson, he's talking about, might use power not only to manipulate others but to help others and more for those who most needed help. Johnson said, you know, when he's selling this war on poverty, Lincoln abolished slavery and we're going to abolish poverty. Like, he sees this as his domestic legacy. Okay, so we're going to actually look at how the war on poverty is implemented, how they spent money through the Community Action Program. This is not the entire war on poverty. It's just this little snippet, but it turns out to be a very useful one because the funding was unconstrained in a lot of ways, so it allows us to document where things went. We're going to assemble a lot of data that I'm not going to tell you anything about, but this was by far what took the longest for this project. and then the analysis. We're going to use really, really simple regression analysis. We're going to look at R-squareds to see how much of the variation we're explaining with a model, and then look at partial R-squareds to see how much of the variation is explained, sort of explained in an accounting sense, using by these political type of variables altogether and these poverty variables. We're going to do that at both the state and the county level. So let me give you an overview of the empirical results. CAP spending, Community Action Program spending, adheres very closely to a state-level index that they put in the legislation. You might find this surprising or not, because, in fact, there's no enforcement. If Shriver hadn't done this, there was not much that Congress could do other than sort of the immediate political pressure they could have exerted on the Johnson administration. So adherence increases over time as they get set up. Discretionary funding, that this is the 20% of that budget that Shriver had absolute discretion over, actually seems to follow the poverty index as well. So spending on that seems proportional. And here's another interesting finding, is that the narrative is typically that the South gets more. When we think about the war on poverty, at least a lot of people, they think about what's going on in the South. But in fact, the South gets less in terms of Community Action Program dollars than other places in the United States. I wasn't expecting to find that. That is after accounting for the index. So the other thing is the community action spending within states is completely unconstrained by the legislation. They can do anything they want. They can put it, they can give it to private organizations anywhere. And so we look at all of these political variables, and I'm going to give you a really long list. It's going to take up the entire slide. And then I'm going to tell you that, in fact, all the stuff we can think of to throw at this, really were explaining very little of the variation in funding, which I actually find very, very surprising. And in fact, when we looked at Price's data, thanks for sharing that data, by the way, Price, to do the same thing for New Deal funding, actually they get much higher R-squares for the same types of regressions. So it's the striking difference between what are they doing, we're not explaining much. It's true that they invested in political strongholds and they tended to reward swing districts, those especially that swung to Democrats in the 64 election. But really, this is explaining an economically very small part of what's going on. The poverty variables here have the most explanatory value, and there's two poverty variables we're using. We're using different types of poverty measures, so it's whether or not the share of a county population below 3,000, but we also look at the intensity of poverty using 1,000 and 2,000 as a threshold, and the share of the population that's non-white. So those are the two things we have. By far, those are doing the most work here. Okay, so what does the spending pattern bring at the end of the day? Is there a new Democratic consensus, anything like that? Voter turnout does increase in more non-white areas especially, but also in poorer areas. That's good. But not really outside the non-South. But here's the backlash. Those votes tend to go to Republicans. So that's a really interesting thing. In poorer areas, the Democrats do pick up some of those votes, but they don't do very well. So how am I doing on time? Okay, about halfway through. So let me give you a brief history of the 1964 Economic Opportunity Act. This, we talked about yesterday, is one of the centerpieces of Johnson's War on Poverty. A lot of people refer to it synonymously with the War on Poverty. So poverty really emerges as this new and urgent social issue. Alice talked a lot about that in the 1960s. There's some debate about whether or not the War on Poverty would have happened without Johnson. Heller has an account that sort of makes it sound more like Kennedy might have done something. It's not really clear. We don't know. But when Johnson hears about this program, he's like, that's my kind of program. He gives him this unequivocal, full speed ahead, let's do it. So here he is, after a State of the Union. You know he means business because he appoints Sergeant Shriver, who's a political heavyweight. That is, he knows people in Congress. He's very effective in getting things done. So he didn't choose someone who wasn't going to be able to do stuff. He chooses Shriver to head the Poverty Task Force. And Shriver apparently consults with hundreds and hundreds of people in the first few weeks he's there. And I want to tell you who these people are, according to these accounts. Leaders in agriculture, business, labor, civil rights, government, academics, administrators, and foundations. That all sounds very reasonable if you're an academic. But if you were going to do something poverty-related in the 1960s, you might be surprised. There are no social workers, welfare administrators. These people who are sort of that old school of thought on how we were going to do anti-poverty stuff get neglected here. They get left out. And this is something that upsets a lot of folks. He goes after they've got this poverty task force. He goes on this April public relations tour to really promote the poverty program. And that's where all these pictures you're seeing in the newspaper now of Johnson sitting on people's porches. Here he is with Tom Fletcher. And he says on this tour, I don't know if I'll pass a single law or get a single dollar appropriated, but before I'm through, no community in America will be able to ignore poverty and its midst. And he does make it into this big, high-profile national issue. So the task force drafts a bill, and without any consultation with Congress, sends it over on March 16th. January 8th, March 16th. Okay, this is happening really fast. So the bill creates this Office of Economic Opportunity in the executive with large discretionary power. Passage in the Senate happens pretty quickly, 61-34. After 2 days of debate, passage in the House is trickier. It takes 3 days. It's a little bit more contentious. Here are the things that they wanted changed. They were really worried about Shriver's power. So Southern Democrats and conservative Republicans, they wanted to kind of rein in the power of the director. That's one of the ways this index gets introduced. And they also managed to give governors veto power over dollars except those going to other parts of government. Now, they also managed to turn back a state's rights amendment and provisions to channel funds through local poverty agencies. Again, you can imagine, how did they want to direct this stuff? They were trying to keep this money out of the hands of the people who they thought hadn't done a particularly good job at fighting poverty. So the final enactment happens by August that year, 27 pages, vote in the House, 226 on the amended version to 185. So I read a couple of people saying that Johnson managed to pass this around Republicans. And I think there were some Republicans he passed it around. But remember, this is before the 1964 election. There are lots of Republicans who support this bill. Well, publicly, I should say. Okay, so the Economic Opportunity Act has some pretty radical provisions in there. About half of its money went to programs that were directly linked to D.C. in terms of their administration. But the other part of the money went to the Community Action Agency, CAAs, to coordinate locally customized programs. And now, when you think about what is this money for, these are things, anything, which provides services, assistance, or activities to give the promise of progress towards the elimination of poverty or the causes of poverty. This is extremely broad. Let me just skip through some documents. There's an index that gets put in there, again, to rein in the power, to make sure no states get shortchanged. But the OEIO has complete discretion within states. Funds didn't flow to or through state or local governments. Programs were to be conducted, administered, or coordinated by a public or nonprofit agency. So it's all of these organizations that hadn't really gotten federal dollars to do this type of stuff before. And the OEO wants to use this provision, or the idea is to circumvent the institutions that had been complicit or instrumental in the exclusion of folks. Either you can think about racial discrimination or the exclusion of the poor from a lot of the decision making. And this provision, the idea is, can facilitate a lot of institutional change. You can imagine why this could be important. The financial stakes were small. No one would have cared too much. But I'm going to argue here that the financial stakes are actually bigger than you might think. So the OEO is demanding. Shriver has strings. There are a number of very high-profile showdowns. He was going to do stuff his way, and he did. So he made it matter. Also, the federal funding is about $2.64 billion for the CAP program. That's in 1968 dollars. So I inflated that, and then I went searching this morning in the current budget to see what was about that size, just to kind of put this in perspective. And I found this reference to NASA as about a budget the size of that today. So this may not seem like a lot of money in comparison to all the things the federal government is spending money on, but it's a heck of a lot of money for things for the poor in local communities. So for instance, we compare it to the 1962 expenditures from local governments on welfare and related stuff. This is about a 25% increase over all counties in the United States. And for 800 counties, the average Real Community Action Program spending would have doubled local welfare spending. So this is a lot of money. And the other thing is they have this very ambiguous thing written in their maximum feasible participation that people have made fun of, saying maximum feasible confusion and other types of things, right? Because what does that mean? But they wanted participation of the constituents, the people who were supposed to be in the programs or benefiting from the programs on these boards. And they had a lot of trouble doing this, both because people who had control didn't want to invite them, and also because, you know, you've got to get people involved in doing things that they hadn't been doing before. So the EOA gives a lot of discretion over a meaningful amount of money to these organizations and people who hadn't had those types of funds before. And the other thing I said last night as well is, so the other thing this does is it kind of shifts who has control of this money or potentially has control of this money to a very different set of folks than in the past. This is also, I think, pretty important. Okay, so we know what this is. So does the OEO comply with the index? This is kind of one of the first things we thought. So Johnson can basically do anything. They're not going to do much except fire Shriver, maybe. But he's a pretty powerful guy, so maybe not, if he doesn't do what he's supposed to do. I don't know what happened here. Okay. So we're going to do this analysis at two different levels. So first we're going to look at the index, the state-level funding. Is this binding? Does it look like it guided funding in a meaningful way? And the second thing is we're going to associate spending patterns per capita in counties across the United States with a lot of different covariates, in fact, a whole bunch of them. So here's the index. It's equally weighted of equal weights on three different components. UE is the state's share of the nation's unemployment. PK is the state's share of the nation's poor kids. And PA is the state's share of the nation's public assistance recipients. So to give you an example of the way this works, Michigan had about 3.9% of the nation's public assistance recipients, 4% of its unemployed, and 2.7% of its poor kids. Average those together, you get about 3.55% of the index-eligible funding through the cap. index eligible is 80% of their appropriation. The other 20% is discretionary. Okay. So what did the OEO do? I think this, there's tons that we had a lot more in the paper. We've taken a lot out of the paper, but this is kind of one of the most best part of this project is we get to look and see all of these things that Shriver was doing. He got in a fight with a lot of people, and so did the Johnson administration over these funds. And so one of the examples we picked out that stayed in the paper is this idea of and I think this relates back to why you might think the South got fewer dollars, of this showdown with John McKeithen. So in 1965, Louisiana's governor announced the appointees to the Community Action Program. Now, Shriver, to run it. Now, Shriver doesn't have the ability to veto those folks, but he can withhold funds. He doesn't have to send them the check, which he doesn't. Objections were sent to Washington that these appointees were rabid segregationists. People were really upset about this, and Shriver basically withheld money. Now, McKeithen appeals. He calls him. He goes to see people in Congress. He even shows up and gets completely snubbed by Shriver. There's a really nice story about that. And he goes back. And ultimately, he changes the appointees. And then the OEO sends them some money. That's the way that went. There are lots of other examples where the OEO backed down. So it's not at all clear that Shriver, given constraints of like who was going to take it or where you could put it, would actually comply with the index at all. But it doesn't look bad. And so let me tell you what we've done here. So this is the amount of state funding the state should have gotten according to the index on the horizontal axis. This is 65, 66, 67, 68. And this is the actual Community Action Program allocations. And the 45-degree line is the solid one. And the dashed line is the regression fit. So one of the things you can see in 65, places are, you do see this positive correlation, but they're a lot more spread out. In 66, you see a lot more clustering, and you also see the regression fit moving up. That's consistent with this discretionary funding being appropriated in proportion to the index. 67, it gets better, and then 68. And so cumulatively, it doesn't look so bad. So you can actually look to see what the relationship is between the index apportioned funds in the particular fiscal year and the dependent variable here, the real federal cap funding, with no other covariates here. So a couple of things to look at. The R-squareds here are really high. So this is explaining a whole lot of the cross-state variance. And the other thing is the cumulative apportioned funds. So here we just pool everything. So how much, according to the index, should you have gotten? How much do you actually get over the entire period? Because they have trouble getting things started and, you know, getting things set up, funds flowing to places. It takes a while. But cumulatively here, they get about 1.2, which is almost 1.25 of their index appropriated fund, which is exactly what you would have expected, right, if they followed the index both with the funds that they were required to as well as that discretionary funding. Okay, but now we do the same regression here, including fixed effects for just region, to see, are there meaningful differences, say, after accounting for the index in the amounts you get, say, in the South? And it, one of the things that comes out here is, especially over the entire period, the South is a meaningful outlier. Here the omitted category is the Northeast. The South gets much less than you would have guessed. So a little summary of these findings. I know I'm going to have to go through this fast, but the EOA index is not absolutely binding. They're not right on that line. But Shriver used it, and it explains a hell of a lot of what's going on across states. The South is a negative outlier, and southern states averaged about $11 million over the entire period in real terms than northeastern states after accounting for the index. And finally, the OEO allocated discretionary cap funds across states in proportion to the index. I find that kind of surprising because there's no reason that they needed to do that. But I also take this as a hint that Democrats came up with this index as an alternative to the Republican proposal, that this index may have represented what they wanted to do with the money to begin with, which is what I'll show you with the county level data. Okay, so now we're going to do the within state level spending. There's no constraints on what the OEO can do here. Choices indicate, you can think about this as like where they actually wanted to put funds or put them, subject to the constraint of being able to get people to take them. And it helps you understand how they were implementing this program across the country. What were they targeting? Were they targeting powerful congressmen? Were they targeting swing districts? Were they trying to sort of infiltrate Republican districts and spend more on them to try and get to bring them over to the... I mean, they could be doing all sorts of things with this money. You can imagine a big kind of Johnson-esque strategy to kind of get more Democrats in his corner, right? That's what I would have thought. And when I first started this, and also knowing the New Deal literature, this is exactly what I thought he would have been doing. The other thing is, like, he might actually have been fighting poverty or trying to, directing it at poorer places and these types of things. That might have not been as politically wise. You might be able to get more bang for your buck actually investing in these other ways. But, you know, they might have been doing some of those, too. These aren't mutually exclusive hypotheses. And when we first started writing the paper, we looked at stuff like race riots. Are the intensity of race riots correlated with the amount of funding you get? Because there's lots of narratives saying they were trying to do that, but it turns out that there's no association at all, and I think in some part because they're really bad at predicting where these things were going to happen, and two, after they happened, you know, they were both paying in these places and also trying to pay other places to prevent them. So it doesn't end up being related at all. Vietnam, you can't get a measure of Vietnam mobilization at the county level, but you can get a measure of casualties. So we use this at the county level to try and say, well, is he putting money, and there's this... There's some stories about how the Johnson administration uses these types of funds to buy off some leaders in the civil rights movement, right? So they're complicit in sort of Vietnam in exchange for this other money they're getting and the support on civil rights. So you might think that they're putting more money in certain places with higher casualty rates, things like that. In fact, we don't see any evidence of this. We went through the sharecropping hypothesis. We look at Southern paternalism. We look at actually a whole lot of different things, and nothing really pops out. Except, I'll tell you two variables, share non-white and poverty. Okay, let me tell you. So, but before you get too excited about that, let me tell you where these funds went. They went all over the country. Darker means they got more money. Lighter means they got less. So community action program funds get spent everywhere. They didn't have to spend them everywhere. They could have spent them anywhere within states. But they do. You can see that there's a real preference, you think, on the part of the administration for distributing these things broadly. So we're going to look at these data. We're going to first demean the CAP data because we know that they're constrained at the state level. So taking account of the mean that they get in a particular state over time, we're going to take that out. And then we're going to look at that residual, the difference there, the demeaned CAP program expenditures. This is for the entire period on a whole lot of things. I told you I was going to show you a really huge list because when we started having trouble finding associations, we kept thinking of more things to look for. Okay, I mean, we started with some strong things, but we thought, gosh, is it really possible that politics can't matter? So let's go find another bunch of variables, encode all these committee members, look at all of these other types of things that we think should matter. What comes out of that entire exercise is that not much does. Let me give you a sense of what's in there. We use the inverse population ratio, which is standard in the New Deal literature, the 1964 Democratic presidential vote share, whether Johnson won a county, whether the presidential election was close, that is this a swing area? We do this by different numbers of points. The interaction of whether the election was close and Johnson won. So swing districts he won or swing districts he just lost. Is he putting more money on either side of that threshold? And the difference in Democratic vote share between the 1964 and 1960 presidential election. So you can see the swing towards the Democrats for Johnson. Is he rewarding that new constituency that elected him the most liberal Congress since the New Deal? The proportion of county representatives that are Democrats, the indicator variables for whether any of the county's representatives were members of major committees, whether or not they were chairs, whether minority leaders, all sorts of things in Congress. You think he might be putting money in the districts of people who are actually going to matter for the rest of his agenda. Let me see what else here. I've kind of given you. We also have just a handful of poverty measures, and we worked really hard to get these intensity of poverty measures out of the Putnam file that were in this really old IBM format that we then, I would say, That's the royal we. Nick Duquette, who is a whiz and my co-author and is a PhD student, actually worked really, really hard to get this transformed from an unknown, undocumented format into one that we could use. So here we use the share of the county population, households with annual incomes with less than 3,000. We also then, using these intensity of poverty measures, can use less than 2,000 and less than 1,000. And the share of population that is non-white. Remember, non-whites are a lot poorer than whites in this period. And Johnson explicitly talks about that. But this is also really tightly related to the civil rights angle. And actually, this is something I've thought a lot about. I'm not sure how to interpret that, but share non-white ends up being extremely important. Okay, and then we include a lot of other covariates to test these things. So Alston and Ferry, Vietnam measure, riot intensity. I'm going to just suppress all of that because I'm going to tell you we didn't see anything interesting. Oh, we also include things like the size of local governments in terms of its total expenditures per capita or its welfare expenditures per capita, tax revenue per capita, all sorts of things to try and measure local provision of services. And then we include a lot of standard demographic covariates, like the share of the county's population in urban areas. That's, you're going to think, is going to be a really important one, thinking about urban poverty, especially race. And then other types of things that are fairly standard, and whether or not the household is affluent. Okay, here's the summary of results. I tried to put the table up here in regression coefficients, but it turns out, you know, that coefficients are very hard to interpret in terms of standard deviations and dollars and stuff. And so I'm just going to, and it's early, so I'm just going to summarize what our findings are. So the community action program spending within states turns out, interestingly, not to be correlated with much at the aggregate level. And we're throwing in everything we can find here. We kept on going to get more data. The R-squareds are really, really low when we include all of these variables, and they range from something like 4 to 9%. So we do find a statistically significant but economically very small relationship between these political variables, political strongholds, and swing counties, especially those that swung in favor of the Democrats. But these turn out to be very, very small. I mean, they're statistically significant associations, but they're economically very small. And to contrast this with the New Deal literature, so we get prices data, we use your models, and we come up with variables that are very comparable. You can't be exact in the 1960s and the 1930s. And there, the political variables are explaining 25% of the variation in county-level funding. It's a really big difference. And when in our models, using this like almost the same comparable variables, they explain less than 1%. So this is a really big difference, I think, in the way these programs are set up. Another thing here is that the poverty variables have most of the explanatory power, especially the share non-white. That's what I just told you. Now, there's really interest. Of course, we have to break this apart by self, non-self. So the model explains a lot of the variation, interestingly, in the non-self. Here, if you break it out for those counties, we have our squares that are about 42%. We're explaining about 42% of the variation. And about 25% is the poverty variables. It's 2% the political variables. What about the South? There's like, we really can't explain much there. We throw everything in we can think of. We're getting these really, really low R squares. In poverty and politics aren't doing much either. Let's come back to my list of explanations. So why did the war on poverty, quote, fail? There's lots of narratives. And I told you, I mean, you can't completely discount these things, and that's not my intention. But my point is, showing you those figures at the beginning of the talk, is that when you kind of look at the data, and you look at how much poverty rates fell, and you look at what people were saying at the beginning of the 1970s, those things don't seem consistent with some of the facts of the period. I think that's a really interesting thing. And so I think there's a lot more scope to think about these types of explanations. What are the political failings? How did the strategy not work? How much of it is just that we just don't like Johnson? So I can't say much about that, but I think it's an important thing. There's something really important here, is that the war on poverty, and I kind of alluded to this before, Johnson doesn't want to go through this old school way of dealing with poverty. He doesn't want to include these social workers or welfare caseworkers, these types of folks. He wants to do these other types of things. He wants to change the way things are done. So he goes around them. This pisses people off on the left, you can imagine. Now, there's also community action and civil rights that he's attaching. So there are big stakes in complying with a lot of these things. And he's also sending a lot of the money through channels that they're not going through these traditional channels, not like the New Deal. This upsets a lot of people, too. So in some sense, Johnson has set up this program and designed it in a way that everyone on the left is mad at him for not doing enough, for underfunding the programs, and for not including the people that they thought should have been included. And people on the right are upset because of federal overreach, because there's too much going on, there's too much pressure, and they're not there's not enough local control. So he sets up this program that no one likes. Okay, so coming back to why the war on poverty failed and sort of this bigger narrative that we've believed, I think, for a very long time, I include myself in this, I think that we should give a lot more thought to the political failings of the way this program was implemented. The quantitative reasons we show in this paper, this is just through the lens of the Community Action Program, which is just a subset of what's going on there, but I think it's kind of a metaphor for the bigger picture of what's going on in this period. So 25% of the New Deal funding is spending is explained by these types of federal political variables, and almost none of the cap spending is explained by those same types of variables. And believe me, we looked for everything we could. The other thing we do in the paper is we look to see, we do this kind of backlash analysis. So what are the voting patterns that are associated with these spending patterns? Do we see more voting? Do we see more turnout in places where they were putting more of these dollars? That's what you would think with community action, right? They're mobilizing people. They're trying to bring people into the political process. The Voting Rights Act is important, but they've got a lot of people on the ground actually working to do those registration drives, legal services lawyers trying to get people included where they had previously been excluded because of a lot of the things that were going on at the polls. So you might think that this actually increases turnout a great deal in those places where they were sending more money. And in fact, that's what we find. With share non-white and share in poverty explain or are correlated with this big change in voter turnout. But here's the problem. The turnouts, a lot of this seems to be backlash, at least against the Johnson administration, because the share going to Republicans in those areas is going up, or the share that Democrats aren't getting is going up, so share going to Republicans. So Democrats do gain some votes in poor counties, but nearly enough to make up for the number they lost in share non-white. So I'll stop there. Thanks.
I'm Ann Stevens, the director of the Center for Poverty Research at UC Davis, and I want to thank you for listening. The center is one of three federally designated poverty research centers in the United States. Our mission is to facilitate nonpartisan academic research on domestic poverty, to disseminate this research, and to train the next generation of poverty scholars. Core funding comes from the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services. For more information about the center, visit us online at poverty.ucdavis.edu.